From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in decelerating Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, I'm so excited. Our topics are curling, you know the sport, and off-ramps, like when you are done with the game. So if everyone's ready, let's start.
Little giddy today?
I'm so excited. What are you gonna say about curling? I'm not literally on the edge of my seat, but I might be in a couple seconds. So,
well, before we get into all that, it hot, fam.
Yeah, accurate description. Yeah.
Steven, one of you was saying earlier off mic that as Minnesotans, we talk about the weather all the time.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's because our weather is extreme and always changing.
Yep.
Yes.
We don't like that we talk about the weather. We just literally can't help it.
Yeah.
It's always on our minds.
Yeah.
Right now it is 101 degrees Fahrenheit in Minneapolis.
And or like 70% humidity.
Yeah, that's what the not the heat, it's the humidity, right? Right. That's 38 Celsius for those everywhere else.
Yeah.
Very, very hot. Mm. We're air conditioned here in the clubhouse.
Thank goodness.
But this room in the office, it heats up a little quicker when there's three bodies in it.
Right.
So it's not ideal. We have a fan. We turn it off before we start the recording.
Yes.
I mean, it could be worse. We've had some hot recording sessions.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Back at Glitch, sometimes the air we had to turn the air conditioner off and it was super hot.
It was too noisy. So we always had to turn it off.
Yeah. That
on real hot. Ooh, it was
unpleasant.
Really, yeah.
Well, there was a lot of window space.
Yep.
And I
yep.
think it was facing a direction where there was a lot of sun. And I don't remember there being lots of blinds.
No.
There weren't blinds at all.
Nope.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we're like, definitely multiple features.
So what do we have to complain about is the short.
We live in Minnesota. This is it's our right.
Exactly.
Minnesotans to complain. Yeah.
It is our birthright.
There's a grocery store right next to the office
yeah.
and I'll just hop over there for snacks or whatever. And I mean, when I say just next door, it's like there's an alley between us.
Yeah.
It's not a walk at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so torturous just to walk back and forth. It was so frustrating. I was walking back and somebody stopped me, like asked for the time or something. And I was so mad at them for making me stand outside for 5 more seconds.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to whoever that was because I was not in a good mood.
Yeah, it was not the time for that. No.
It's rough. Well, like that is the thing about Minnesota is like if you aren't prepared and you go out in the winter, you might die. If you aren't prepared and you go out in the summer, you might die.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, the national there was an extreme heat warning. It
right.
is really dangerous. It can be.
Yeah.
I mean, because we have these extreme temperatures, we do every. I mean, so many. There's not a lot of places that are not air conditioned and heated for
right.
the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But in some places in the country that get these heat waves from time to time, they just don't need it all the time, and so you give a lot more. Health incidents, like people, you know, heat stroke and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
We're a little bit lucky because as a culture, Minnesotans have dealt with this every year.
Mm.
It's extreme. So we're a little better prepared, but it still is dangerous.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Drink your water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drink your water and stay in the shade.
Yeah. I took a bike ride all around town. It was yesterday, the day before, and it was
crazy.
It was like 88 or something.
Mm.
And it was, as long as I was moving at 10, 15 miles an hour.
What a breeze.
Yeah,
if I was going slower than that, I was just like, what am I doing out here?
Yeah. Well, and you have I don't want to get too off topic, but I have questions for you about your e-bike. And
yeah.
one of them is, do you have to pedal really hard when it's hot?
No. It has like a boost assist.
Yeah.
So like if you're lazy, you just press this button and it like, it's kind of like, you know, nitrous for your e-bike.
Yes.
You try not to use it because it drains the battery a lot quicker.
Mm.
But no, it has a top speed of 20 miles an hour by legally. Otherwise, you have to class another type of vehicle.
Hmm.
But if you hold that button down,
you can really get going.
You can get to 20 and stay there for a while.
Okay.
Without a lot of effort.
Noted.
Yeah.
Okay, but yeah. And also, there's like something about a birthday, and let's talk about curling. No, let's talk about birthday.
Yeah.
So
listeners heard
to.
Last week, it was Steven's birthday last week from where you, the listener, was sitting.
Yes.
It's not yet Steven's birthday where we're sitting, but huzzah, celebrate, anyway?
I'm going to get real with listeners for a little bit here.
Get real.
Because it's like, I have been looking forward to my golden birthday for a long time.
Yeah.
But because of COVID and me not feeling comfortable and... me not feeling comfortable in social situations as much, and me not having as much social energy as I used to just due to the fact that, you know, we've been isolating for so long. I haven't been looking forward to this year.
Yeah.
Also, it means I'm getting older. It's my golden birthday.
Yeah.
For listeners who are not aware, golden birthday means it's just like the your age is the same as the day of the month you were born.
Mm-hmm.
So I already made it clear my birthday is June 30th, so I'm turning 30.
Yes, big round number.
Yes. Join us.
We'll both be in our 30s for a brief time.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah. I haven't really been looking forward to my birthday in the same way that I had been before.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad. But I am on the week, I guess, of the recording that y'all heard, I would have been at Summer Games Done Quick. And I took the whole week off, and I'm going to be there the whole week. So.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that part of it.
I
forgot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it happened to be on my birthday. Oh,
that's
so
perfect.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were taking the whole week off for it.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fun. You'll report back?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe you'll do a little bit of recording on site?
I was thinking about doing that. See if there's some game speed runners who are interested in talking to Nice Games.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, and I mean, we did it off of my phone before, we could do it again. So yeah, that's that.
Well, one of your other birthday traditions I know is that you go see a Pixar movie, because for some reason they're always in theaters.
They're in theaters like around June.
I didn't realize it was such clockwork with that studio.
Well, in the past few years, it hasn't been the case. Actually, like,
well, yeah,
even before pandemic.
Yeah, the last three Pixar movies went to Disney Plus, or, you know, either it like skipped theaters.
Yeah, but even before pandemic stuff, and even before, like, you know, Disney Plus existed, I think they'd been a little off. Like, some of them, it came out in like March or something.
Yeah. Well, there's one in theaters now.
There is, and
is
I actually forgot about it.
Wait, which one? I don't know.
It's Lightyear. It's
oh yeah, yeah, it's the Buzz Lightyear. Of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually that excited about this movie.
Yeah.
So I haven't been thinking about it. But I might. I don't know. Maybe I'll
it's
go
got
watch
me- real mixed critical.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Feedback.
Okay.
People are, like, no one's saying it's a disaster, but I think people expected better, more of it.
Yeah. This is a Pixar.
Because it's kind of such a good idea.
Yeah.
I think people just thought there would be more. It'd be more like it would wow them more, which is sort of their fault, I guess, for expecting that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I guess that's why. I guess I didn't realize it was a Pixar movie, because to me it seemed more like a Disney animated studios movie.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they're almost the same. It's hard, like, I can tell the difference because I've been watching Pixar movies all my life. But
right.
Yeah, it didn't seem like it was a Pixar movie, but now I know it's a Pixar movie. I guess I should try to go watch it.
I think that I can understand why, though, because like Toy Story it's been around a while.
Right.
And most other Pixar movies don't have sequels.
Pixar's first, or it's their second movie was a sequel.
Yes.
And then they didn't do sequels for a long time.
Yeah.
And then they started doing almost nothing but sequels.
Yeah, for a while. Nah.
But in the past 5 years, a bunch of originals. Mm-hmm. So they're now just doing a little bit of both.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what's great, Stephen, is this has given you a great preview of your 30s.
Yeah.
Which
okay.
Which is like having really high expectations and having, you know, but everything just not being quite as good as you'd hoped.
Ah.
Oh.
Cool.
But like still things are still good.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
But you lose all the innocence of youth.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Yeah.
That wasn't my experience at all.
Oh, no?
My experience was like do oh crap. I'm 30, and then it was like, "Oh, okay, it's not very different." Oh no, I'm 36. What?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I got to watch out for 36.
Nothing special about 36. I just lost count.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. I might have told this story on the show before, but when I turned 36, I was like, oh, I'm in my mid, I've passed the half point. So I'm in my late 30s. Mm. And so I must be 38. And so for 3 years, I thought I was 38.
Oh.
And I only turned 38 just recently.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, it was weird because I'm like, oh, I'm finally the age I thought I was the last 3 years.
Huh.
So very strange.
That's fascinating.
Turns out. Same thing happened to my sister. She said that's exactly what happened to me when I was that age.
Wow.
You just think you're 38 for a while. I don't know if anyone else has that experience, but apparently it's not unique to just me.
Okay. What if you can like surprise yourself in reverse? It's like, I think I'm 50.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wait a second. No, I'm not. I'm only 38.
Right.
Curling.
Yeah. What
curling?
The
We're just going to go right into it now?
I think so.
Unless we can come up with a better transition.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Okay, so curling is a well, most people know it from the Winter Olympics.
Right.
It's it people joke about it. It's a little weird, right? The,
yeah.
The sweepers and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll just lay out the basic rules of the sport, and then I'll get into why I chose it as a topic for the show.
That's really what I'm here for.
Yeah. So in curling, you have like a lane. Players are at one end. Each player has a like a 30-pound stone that they put on the ice. It's got a little handle on it.
Okay.
And then they slide it down to the other side of the field, which has a like a giant target in it. That's about, I don't know, actually know all these like exact specifications. It's like 12 feet wide or something.
Yeah.
And the right in the center of it is where you're aiming. So it's like horseshoes, basically, or any kind of, or darts, or any kind of thing like that.
Okay.
And so teams alternate back and forth, throwing rocks down the field. They can knock others out of the way. Mm-hmm. They can position them in a way so that they'll have more that are closer to the center, which is called the button. Mm-hmm. And
cute.
You score when, at the end of an end, after everyone's tossed all the stones, the closest stone to the button gets a point. And if the next closest stone is from the other team, then that's where the counting stops. But basically, you count up until you reach a stone from the other team.
Hmm.
So most ends, they're called an end, like an end is what they're called. Most ends result in 1 point for one team.
Sure.
And so that makes curling extremely strategic because you very often, because when you do win an end, you then go first in the next one and you want to go last.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you'll be in a position where you will secure 0 points to get a more advantage next time around.
Fascinating. Okay.
You like there's three ends left.
Yeah.
And if we go and if teams go back and forth as to who scores, then there's a good chance we're going to lose. All right. Well, then let's just it's called blanking an end where nobody gets any points. Mm. And you do that so that you maintain your position as the last person who throws. But you're closer to the end of the game, so there's fewer opportunities for the other team to catch up.
Yeah.
So that's just a taste of how like complex the strategy of curling is.
Hmm.
It's called chess on ice.
Who calls it chess on ice?
A lot of people call it that, like unironically.
What? Okay.
It's an incredibly strategic game.
Huh.
And that's why I love it, because it's a sport that uses as much of your body as it uses your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, of course, there's, you know, almost any sport uses your mind. It's not like, I'm not trying to like, you know, damn every other sport.
Yeah.
But the thing about curling is it's just very much a game.
Yeah.
As much as it is a sport. And so the thing about curling that's special though, other than the game is kind of great. The thing about curling that's unusual, and you'll see every 4 years when the Winter Olympics rolls around, you'll see people talk about like, what's so weird about curling? It has no referees.
Ooh.
It's entirely self-governed, even at the Olympic level.
Goodness.
And there's a couple reasons for that, and the things, and I'll get into those. But what's super interesting about it is it's this thing called the spirit of curling, and it's part of the rules of curling.
Oh,
even outside of its like governing body and leagues and all of that,
yeah.
It's if you play curling like as like a hobby, you will hear about the spirit of curling, which is like essentially part of the rules.
Okay,
and so I've copied it down here. I'm not gonna, maybe I won't read the whole thing, but a couple of the choice parts are
sure.
You know, curling is a game of skill and tradition. A shot well executed is a delight, and it's also a fine thing to observe the time-honored traditions of curling being applied in the true spirit of the game. So right away it starts out with like, let's all hold hands and be friends.
Uh-huh.
Like that's essentially, and so then the paragraph ends with curlers play to win, but never to humble their opponents. And that is like a key concept in curling culture.
Okay.
Hmm.
Which is that you like, it's not worth winning if everyone is angry at each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and in curling clubs in the snowy places where curling is popular, you know, it's very frequent that, you know, the winning team will then, you know, get dinner for the losing team. Like it's so friendly a sport and it's unusual. And I think I've talked about on the show before. I probably mentioned curling in this context about like what I don't like about competitiveness in games and how I feel like it brings out the wrong things in a lot of people.
Sure.
And curling is like the example that I like to bring is like, this is what I think all competitive games should be. But there are some things that make it this way
that are,
I think maybe easy enough to prove, but a lot of things that I think is really theory. So I want to get into it, and maybe we can talk about, like, how would we design a game that has that kind of spirit, that can be highly competitive, that can have, it could be an Olympic sport. There's that much to master about it. But at the same time, it doesn't need referees.
Yeah.
Like, it's such an unusual anomaly. Wild. And I think you can design a game like that.
Like,
and
even fighting games have referees.
Yeah. Right. And
like, it's a video game. The game tracks what you're doing. Like, that's... Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing about it is the culture.
Yeah, okay.
So curling's culture is just really, really surrounded by this. Mm-hmm. It is, I mean, it's taboo to like, not reveal your mistakes. I mean, one of the rules in curling is you can only call a foul against yourself.
Wow.
Like, that's how it works. Blah. And the thing is, I've seen it happen in Olympic games.
Yeah.
Somebody makes a mistake, they touch a stone as it's moving down, they're not supposed to, and I didn't notice it. And no one else on the thing noticed it. The person calls them out and they lose a gold medal over it.
Wow.
Like, that is part of curling. Because if you're the person who makes that mistake and you don't call yourself out on it and you win the game, you will not enjoy that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because the culture of the game is really, really built around this. Like, it's not just about scoring the points.
Yeah.
And that's why that phrase, they play to win but never to humble their opponent.
Yeah.
Like, you play to win, you don't actually play to beat the other team.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Even though you are competing with them. And it's like a mindset. And so that's the struggle I have with this, describing this. It, like, is it just an anomaly in the world, or is it something we can actually design for?
Yeah.
Because I think the two reasons that make it that way are this sort of like ephemeral, up in the air kind of just notion of friendly competition, which, I mean, all competitive games and tournaments and scenarios, the people who organize it, the people who design the games, and even a lot of the players,
right,
they all believe in sportsmanship. It's
yeah,
no
yeah.
one doesn't believe in it.
Yeah.
And but the curling has it built in so much that I think that is part of it,
mm-hmm.
that is sort of ill-definedness of it. But also I think it's because curling is a very simple, objective game.
Okay.
Like, it doesn't need referees, not just because people are nice to each other,
yeah,
but because it's pretty easy to judge.
It, oh,
like,
sure.
A referee for curling would not have, it would not take a lot of work.
Yeah.
And the game is designed that way. It's okay. Very objective.
Sure.
You know, darts is another example of like a simple game that's objective.
Mm-hmm.
And in darts, like, if you ever see like darts on ESPN or something,
yeah.
like, it's very rowdy. It's
yeah.
like, I mean, it's
well,
like,
it is
it's
a game, bar sport.
Right, exactly. And that culture comes with it.
Yeah.
So it's not that sort of that, you know, there's smack talk and, mm-hmm. and taunting and,
mm-hmm.
and psych outs and all that kind of stuff that in curling is just absolutely against the rules. Like,
hmm.
you are not allowed.
You can't smack talk.
You are not allowed to do anything
oh.
which prevents the other player from playing their best.
Oh wow!
Like, that is against the spirit of curling.
Okay.
Like, you can't. You know, it's and those are subjective.
Yeah.
Things.
Sure.
And there's no referees to govern it.
Right.
To police it.
Yeah.
And because of that, the game would fall apart under those rules if people violated them too much.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, everyone is responsible for keeping it together.
Mm-hmm.
And so violations of that, which are not like the NBA has like a whole fine structure
yeah.
for like, if a player does specifically this thing, they are fined this amount of dollars.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that conduct is policed very specifically. And that's a solution to it. Right.
Right.
Online moderation
yeah.
is, in order to be fair, has a really specific set of rules and a specific adjudication process.
Yes.
Curling doesn't have any of that.
Okay.
And that, I think, is a strength.
Hmm.
Because if it did have all of that, then you've got the strategic mind working. How can I come up to the line of
yes.
that?
Right, yeah.
And still
yeah.
play
yeah.
fair.
Yep, yep, yep.
And that's not nefarious,
mm-hmm.
but it leads to conflicts. But when
yeah.
when that conflict zone is ill-defined,
mm-hmm.
I think, my theory anyway,
yeah.
is that that is one of the reasons why curling can persist, because it cannot survive as a game without everyone keeping that spirit,
right?
Mm-hmm. And so they just do. It's not that they're better sportsmen than people playing other games. It's part of just how the game is put together.
Well, yeah, maybe not inherently better, but their outward behavior might appear to be better.
Yeah,
you know, or at least it's like, you know, if you've spent equal number of years in the sport, then who knows? I mean, it's hard to compare apples to oranges, as they say.
Yeah.
But this is interesting because it's like the game theory of curling includes the culture,
mm-hmm.
because those rules, those penalties are so ill-defined. I think what you're saying absolutely makes sense. It's kind of like if you give something a fine, then that's the fee that you can pay to do the wrong thing.
Like, right, and then you'll be absolved. You did it. You paid your fine. Move on to the next game. Right?
Like, I'll keep speeding if I've got money to pay the ticket. Then it's just that's just like the toll that I pay on speeding.
And even so, like there, like fouls do have consequences. So if you touch a stone as it's moving down the field, you reveal you've done that, and then that stone comes out of play. If it hit another stone before you know, because it's just seconds the thing flies down, you have to do your best to put the things back where they were, right? Hmm. And there's no judge to do it. There's no measure. Like, the teams just agree that's where those were. Hmm. And it's very strange because it's a very precise game as well.
Yeah.
But in the case of, like you pay your penalty, like, in curling, there just isn't enough, there's not enough you could be punished with, essentially. So there's no strategic fouling. Like, you'll see other sports where you will foul a player because it's better to run out some clock time or let them get this many points for their free kick than it would be. And I'm just mixing all these games together. Than it would be to let them perform at their best, because that's game theory. And it's smart, right? Mm-hmm. But curling doesn't have as many opportunities for that kind of play, that kind of meta play. And so that's another one of the reasons. So I think the culture is really important, but I think the design of the game allows for that.
Well, you did describe right in the beginning that meta play, what was it called? The zero end or whatever? Where you try to make it so that no one gets points so that you have a better standing for the last few.
Right, but there's no manipulation that's outside the spirit of it, right? Like, you try to block a player from making a good move, and the only tools you have to do that are the tools you also have to make your own moves.
Well, yeah. I mean, in that way, it's like chess.
Yeah. And I think the because curling is relatively easy to measure objectively, and more so now, the stones have these handles on them that are capacitive. So if you go over there's a line when you throw it down, you have to let it go by, or else it's like bowling basically. When you can't go past the line.
Yeah.
When you're throwing the thing, there will be a beep that happens because there's a little, and that is one of the last hard to measure things.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you stepped over the line. No, I didn't. Right. Like, that's the kind of thing that all sorts of games have.
Right.
But curling has eliminated as much of that as possible so that it is easy for the players to self-govern themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that it's not just that it is not impossible to cheat, right?
Yeah.
It's not totally difficult even
to
manipulate if no one's looking or whatever. I mean, in the Olympics, you have 100 cameras on you, but,
right.
you know, outside of that, it's just that to judging the game doesn't actually take a lot of my headspace.
Okay.
And so a game, like, compared to, say, baseball. Baseball has the strike zone.
Yeah.
You need an umpire for that.
Right.
Because the players are way too motivated to be objective.
Yeah.
And it's too hard to, and, you know, umpires get it wrong all the time, too. Yeah. It's very subjective judgments.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And curling just doesn't have that. Yeah. So, therefore, it's just easier for the players to keep track of what's what.
Yeah.
And because the game is designed that way. You compare it to a video game where the computer is the referee, but there are complicated structures that players can't keep in their heads.
Yeah.
So that's ultimately the players, because they're relieved of the burden of having to track any of that stuff. They then don't understand the importance of tracking that stuff necessarily. So I think that's where video games comes in, where, like, you know, a ref can't make a mistake in a video game.
Right.
Right. There enough things have objectively measured. But the player isn't confirming those objective measures themselves, so there's opportunity for sour feelings or suspicion that there's a problem or some other kind of, like, not just, even if you can't cheat in a video game, it's harder to verify that the other person didn't in your own mind,
right,
in a way. And I think that that's what leads to the because you're free of that burden of having to actually confirm or track that stuff. Curling is super easy. There's just not a lot to it. And I think that's an important part to think about in game design. When you have, like, this is one of the reasons I don't like complicated board games.
Yeah.
Because I feel it's too much for the player to keep in their head. And even if everyone's trying to play fair, it's hard not to have this instinct, like, well, I think I counted it right. Did they count it right? Because if I counted it right and they didn't, but they're the ones deciding who gets those tokens, and then I have to say something.
Yeah.
And that's just an irritating process.
Yeah, I agree.
And even if you're not in a highly competitive mode, that can still lead to conflicts.
Yep.
Even if no rules have been broken.
Right.
Curling is just a little bit easier. So I think I don't want to give too much credit to, like, the history of the curling clubs that keep the spirit alive. I think that would be an overblown explanation for why it's that way.
Sure.
I think the design has a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into that. Mm-hmm. So a couple things came to mind as you were talking about the rules And one thing that comes to mind that I think could be a factor in the, you know, cultural momentum, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe it might be the right word, is that the players are not directly, from what I understand, the players are not directly interacting with each other on the ice, right? It's one team goes, then they step off the ice, and then another team goes.
Yes. It's a slow game.
Right.
For that reason. And yes, there's, it's more, the interactions you make with other players are with your stones interacting with their stones on the play field. Yeah. So it's very objective and unambiguous.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not this live, you might accidentally trip someone. You know, there's not the physical proximity to the other player and the speed involved that might injure someone, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Playing soccer or basketball, you're going to trip and you're going to fall, and it might not be anybody's fault, but maybe it was.
Yeah.
Right? That's not part of the equation here.
Yeah, I think about, like, I mentioned, like, the strike zone in baseball, but the other example I was thinking of is, like, dribbling in basketball.
Yeah.
That's something where it is kind of up to the referees to decide, but also a player can manipulate their position in relation, like, they know where the ref is standing.
Yeah.
So they can take an extra step if they know there are a bunch of players in between them and the ref.
Oh.
It happens a lot. Mm. And there's just way more opportunity to exploit that ambiguity.
So because things are so transparent, it's difficult to cheat even if you wanted to.
Well, it's just that it's easier to play better than it is to cheat. Like, it isn't that hard to cheat. It's just easier to play better.
Okay.
You know?
Sure. Okay. See, I'm really trying to come up with ways to exploit. And
see, this is why when I talk about, like, designing online games,
yeah,
I mean, it has to be done. You have to have all these moderation systems, these anti-cheat pieces of software.
Yeah.
All that is neat because the games are designed that way. But I feel like the way to solve bad sportsmanship in video games as well is to just make cheating not rewarding. And that means games have to be different. Like, that,
well,
there are certain types. It is, when you think, you couldn't do that to League of Legends.
Right. No.
It would have to be a different game. And yeah. I think that, I don't think there are enough people trying to tackle the problem that way.
Well, I mean, I agree. I agree that, especially like with MOBAs and such, like, the toxicity in those communities is largely due to the fact that, like, one player can ruin your experience for the next 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And things like that. So the reason that happens is due to, like, the extreme competitive nature of those games.
Yeah.
And because it's a team game, specifically too. Like, if you're playing by yourself, like in a fighting game, I mean, you can still be a toxic fighting game player, but if you're playing a fighting game, like, you're only ruining the experience for yourself if you act up. I guess for the most part, I guess you can act up and mess up the other person's game. But I mean, like, then you just win. The other person just wins. So you just, like, lose your game just because you got angry. Or
whatever. Well, even in fair play in a fighting game, there's a lot of psychology involved.
Yes.
And that's core to those types of games.
Yes.
Is feints.
Yeah.
Right. Trying to dupe the other player into making a move, trying to goad them,
right?
Trying to annoy them. Yeah. And you do that, you don't have to be yelling at them or in their face. You can do that just with the button presses on your controller.
Yep.
And, like, I'm here to say that's bad.
Okay. That's what I like about fighting games, but that's fine.
Well, because it's really satisfying to do. And
yeah.
It's just, I think it's very, like, it's not itself bad.
No, yeah.
It's just, it's fraught. And I think it requires a lot more... it requires other guards against the what can make those things toxic.
Sure.
I mean, I really feel like games like League and Overwatch and all the games that have famously toxic communities.
Yeah.
I just am so confused how people aren't getting the design of these games is a big part of that.
Because the design of those games is also one of the reasons why they're so successful.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely true.
It's like the question is, like, can you... And this is the challenge I think you're putting forth, is can you design a game that is equally engaging but inherently, like, dissuades that kind of toxicity?
Right, and that gets to the sort of core, the element of stakes, right? The stakes in curling, pretty low.
Yeah.
Like, you can be the best curler in the world, and you can't live off that prize money. Like,
no.
Right? There are sponsors, and there's lots of tournaments, and you can be a professional curler.
Yeah.
But it's just not, the stakes are just not as high as being a professional basketball player or a professional league esports player.
Yeah, for real. That's true.
And so that, I think that is a part of it. And so that might, I think that's ultimately me giving curling too much credit. If it were way more popular, if way more was riding on it.
Yeah.
If you winning meant, a $10 million sponsorship deal, like how long would the spirit of curling stay in place?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
But I honestly don't think that's the number one factor.
Oh, sure.
I think it's a hypothetical. We can't explore,
you can't have deflate gate in curling.
That's true.
Yeah. But part of what that means is like, maybe it would be okay if a lot of our sports and esports were less popular,
Yeah. I mean, I think
we just had more of them.
There is something interesting about like the dynamics of big. When I mean that they're really big, I mean, like you can look at this in a lot of different things, a lot of different areas of like human life and society is when something gets so big that it's just kind of beyond the scope of the an average person's experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you can get some really weird and I think negative dynamics at play like at large. And some of what I, when you're talking about like the need for referees. I can't remember where I was listening to this. Maybe it was a podcast. Maybe it was a conversation. But I was talking to somebody about like the trend of people being really angry at basketball referees.
Yeah.
And how that was a really big problem. And I don't think it would be as big of an issue if the stakes weren't so high. And here's the thing is like kids watching these games, they then start acting that way on the court in their own games. Even if they're like really nice, they think that's what you're supposed to do. That's how you're supposed to act.
Mm-hmm.
So I think... Yeah, I think maybe it'd be better to have lower stakes. Personally, I, as a sports goer, whenever I am a sports goer, I prefer the lower, like, minor leagues or, like, local teams. Yeah. I do not like watching, like, big college games can be fun if I'm watching with a group of people who's, like, from that campus or whatever. But it makes me really uncomfortable when I think about the money that's at play there and what that does to the game. Cause it does do something to the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I think it's one of the reasons that curling can't get popular is because it doesn't have as much drama in that. So I think that the part of the design and a lot of the culture leads to these things. And then it is that way, I think in part because of the lower stakes, but it is lower stakes because of the culture and the design.
Yeah.
And, I guess it just takes a lot of like discipline to design something that when you were saying like it might be less engaging, maybe that's what we should be doing.
I mean, I'm curious if curling was designed in such a way that it, had this stuff, or did it just like happen to have all of these things? I mean, I guess it has the spirit of curling, right?
Yeah.
But like, was that in place at the inception of the game?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, like, curling was invented in medieval Scotland.
Oh.
So... maybe not.
I don't know.
I think they had some rocks and they had some ice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I think that all of these things just happen to be like, not to say, like curling has been around for so long that I can't be like, well, actually curling's not this, because obviously it is. I've been proven wrong already.
When it became an Olympic sport, which is, I don't know when, but it's not that long ago. It did grow in popularity there, and modern curling resulted.
Yeah.
Right. It has been around a long time.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been around in its current state for longer than in living memory is when modern curling began.
And modern curling is when they put in that spirit of curling thing, or what?
I don't know for a fact. What is
modern curling? I guess.
I mean, just like the it as an Olympic sport. That you can buy brushes and shoes.
Got
it's,
it.
You know.
Oh, the more standardization of it, sort of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like rather than just an old game that people play.
Yeah.
In the ice rink when it freezes.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, okay, so that makes sense. So, yeah, I think the impression I'm getting is that a lot of things just happen to be so that, like, all of these things work so that curling is the way that it is. And, I mean, certainly it's not like, but I'm not trying to say that it was just happenstance that all this stuff happened, right? Mm-hmm. The spirit of curling is there for a reason, and that was put in place to create this culture that allows the way that curling is now to exist, right?
Hmm.
But I think a lot of it was just like, I guess I'm just talking out of my rear end. I don't know.
Exactly. Well, I can feel you sort of reaching for a reason that doesn't do what I sort of am kind of hinting towards, which is to invalidate other types.
Well, I think that's what I'm having an issue with, is because curling, the way you describe it, and maybe I'm probably not being fair by that, because you're just describing it the way that it is. But
I'm motivated in the way I'm describing.
That's true. Okay. But the way you describe it is that, like, curling is this thing. And it's the way that it is. And no other sport is like curling. And I'm trying to figure out why the heck curling is this way and no other sport is like this.
Right, yeah.
That's what doesn't make sense to me.
Is no other sport like that?
There probably are some sports like that, but they're probably like small sports.
Well, I think that's kind of what I was sort of drilling down to with, in terms of the design of the game. Mm. It prevents it from changing. Like, you know, I mean, all sorts of games have history of sportsmanship at their core.
Yeah.
It's just that eventually that just gets thrown away as old fashioned because whatever, you know, it's a bunch of like, you know, random highfalutin talk.
Well, part of it is there's no money in that, maybe.
Well, I don't know. Counterpoint. And maybe comparing some things here will help illuminate some interesting things about curling.
Okay.
Let's go back to Scotland.
Yeah.
golf.
Oh yeah, golf.
I feel like golf has some of the same sort of expectations around sportsmanship and observation, right? Spectating. So like the whole like what is it, stereotype of the golf clap?
The golf clap, yeah.
You're not being a maniac because this game requires a lot of focus.
Yeah.
Now also in golf, interestingly, like you're not facing off against an opponent. Like if your ball hits another person's ball, that's a freak accident.
Yeah.
So that's
right, it's not mini golf.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not talking mini golf. Yeah. Mini golf gets wild. but like you are kind of interacting with your ball, and you're using your skill with your clubs to try to meet the goal of getting your ball into the cup in a fewer number of strokes than your opponents. Right. But besides the fact that you're both kind of working towards that goal, there really isn't much direct – there really isn't any direct interaction between the players.
Yeah.
Less so than even in curling, right? Because in curling, like, your stones can interact with each other.
Right. That's part of the gameplay, yeah.
Right.
In golf, there is – I mean, I don't know a lot about this, but in golf, there is, like, you know, you have supporters doing those golf claps, and they maybe do it offbeat to mess up an opponent.
Oh, really?
Like there is a lot of that kind of drama, but it's hard to break through because there's not opportunities in golf.
Yeah.
Like there's not a lot to psych people out, but people do try.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying to imagine, like, if I were in a golf spectator like group and someone like claps offbeat, I'd be like, or like out of turn, I'd be like, just would everyone turn at them and like look at them? I feel like that would be the thing that would happen. The other thing I'm curious about is I don't know anything about polo, the sport where you're like playing with horses.
Yeah.
But the dynamic of golf, I feel, is also like fairly replicated in the dynamic of equestrian sports, because you're not like, unless you're like at the Renaissance Festival and you're like jousting, that's a little bit different. I'm talking about like Olympic level equestrian sports where you're doing like jumping or you're doing eventing or you're doing dressage.
Yeah.
You are competing for a score with your horse, and you are competing against other people who are also going for a high score.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't seem like it really fits the dynamic of curling, nor does it fit the dynamic of all the like the other team sports that we brought up in examples here, like you know, like basketball or hockey or football or whatever. But what about polo? And I'm curious, I don't know anything about polo, but I would be really, really interested in looking into the dynamics around that, because the stakes are high. If you mess up, you can get someone seriously hurt, because you're not just the humans on the field. You also have these flighty prey animals that
it's an extreme sport in disguise.
It kind of is. They're 1,200 pound creatures running around at 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
right. Yeah, I think, I mean, gymnastics is also, like you were describing, like individual equestrian sports, where it's like you just, all the drama and competition and trash talk happens off the field. And so, because it does doesn't give you the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think that what does make curling special is, and you identified it, it's like it is a game where you are directly competing with other people, and yet it still has this like bizarre like, you know, handshakiness where people are just like, yeah, great game. I totally beat you by a million points and it was terrible, but great game. And you had a good time too. And just like this weird, it does seem, if you watch curling in the Olympics, it just seems unnatural. Like how, like those, the people are there. It's like maybe sometimes it might be their only shot. And the competitive stakes are very high.
Sure.
And it just doesn't get to them in the same way. And it's incredible. Hmm. And I would be curious to see if there are other sports like that. Like if the fact that polo is dangerous also encourages people to be less risky. Yeah. Like that, then that could be part of the, you know, like imagine you play a game where there's, you know, there's a swinging pendulum, you know, with the, you know, cut your head off or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to get pretty close to it to play. Uh-huh. I think everybody would be less likely to foul their opponents.
Yeah.
Right. Unless you're a psychopath.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure that's a good, you know, thing to introduce to games, but
no, a swinging pendulum.
But that might be another explanation that might apply to other sports.
Didn't Q do that or something? I don't remember. Anyway,
I mean, probably.
Yeah. Well, that brings me back to one of the other things that I thought was really interesting is like the lack of explicit consequences. So we brought that up earlier when we were talking about like the idea that fines are also like a fee.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they can be a price of admission essentially to the sin of whatever foul you're committing in the game. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about not having those things specified is that then they loom larger in your head. Because, mm-hmm. like, if you cheat and you don't call the fact, like, if you fouled and you caught it and you didn't say anything, and then someone reviews the video footage later and was like, hey, like, your reputation is gone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
it's,
like,
it's meant to matter so much. Because yeah. there are some sports where, you know, someone sneaks by. Like, and you'd be like, oh, you know, that would have been a foul, but they did a thing that made it look ambiguous. Wow, they're really clever. Like, sometimes that is praised mm-hmm. because it is clever, right? To sort of like get up to the rules. But because it isn't as defined and there's no, you know, officials making those calls,
yeah. mm-hmm.
I think you're right. It does, it puts the burden on the player. Mm-hmm. And so they're less likely because they have to, you know, they have to call their own foul. They, you know, they really respect themselves as judges. So, you know,
yeah,
they're less likely to be motivated by other concerns like winning this end or winning this match or winning this gold medal.
Right.
Because the person who's looking out for it, you know, mistakes is themselves.
Right. When you have a referee, you're, I guess, in a way, outsourcing that part of the responsibility.
Yeah.
You no longer have to be accountable for your own sportsmanship because someone else is.
And you have to do that in those sports because you would not be a reliable referee yourself because there's so much going on and so right. much of it is subjective.
And it's yeah. so fast.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. You've got to have a referee. But so, then also the presence of a referee enables or kind of encourages some bad behavior.
Right. So it does go back to the design. It allows for those things to be the way they are. It doesn't make them that way, but it creates an environment where you can have that culture. Because it's not that hard to maintain.
So the game, okay. So in a scenario when you're trying to design a game like curling in this way,
yeah,
it seems like the game needs to be turn based or slow, mm-hmm. slow enough for everybody to be able to judge themselves in a way that.
Well, not necessarily. Think. This okay. is an approach I did with Metro Nexus with the way I show end of match scores.
Uh-huh.
If I show. Score over time.
Yeah.
In the end screen in Metro Nexus. So if you lost, you can still see that maybe you were winning earlier, and that is information that you can be proud of.
Okay.
I also don't track wins match to match.
Yeah.
So there's no sense of like at the end of the round you'd be like, I think I won more, but I don't know. Mm. You know. And this is something that like Overwatch 2 I think is changing the way they're reporting. Like kill-death ratios.
Oh, sure.
I don't remember offhand exactly, but there was a lot of discussion about how, oh, one of the things that was nice about Overwatch was that some of that information was kept from players, so we didn't judge each other, and we didn't get mad at each other, or you know, either for, you know, for whatever reason, because yeah. there's less metrics to put people in buckets.
Yeah.
You mm-hmm. know, a new player isn't going to be teased as much for being a noob if all that reveals them to be new is to be a noob is their performance.
Yeah.
But if you see some authoritative information that says this person sucks,
yeah.
then your opinion has already formed. They're a bad player.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
And so I think it's more, you're not wrong that turn-based games are maybe easier to set up for that, but it isn't outside the reach of other types of games, even ones that are very high, have high level competitive play.
You know, it's interesting as you bring up those metrics too, because a lot of times people will bring up, you know, kill death ratios and stuff, and that is not even a good signifier on how well a player does a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Like, I guess when you get extreme numbers like 0 and 50, that's probably you didn't do good. but like yeah, a lot of those times people will look at those numbers and yeah, like you said, Mark, attribute your skill to those numbers, regardless of the fact that the player can be contributing to the team in other ways.
Yeah.
Right.
Aren't as measurable.
Right.
Yeah.
What it's like the negative side of what gets measured gets improved. Mm-hmm. Except for on online games, what gets measured gets dunked on.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Right. That part of that discussion was about people who were healers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And even in Fingence, the way I've talked to you about this before, that in Fingence you're told what your damage count was, what your tanking count was.
Yep.
But because each character has different strengths,
yeah,
those numbers are never apples to apples.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
And that's that. So it makes them difficult to use for that purpose. But right. But a lot of games have the same problem. They just throw those numbers out there and then they let players make those conclusions where it encourages to make those conclusions.
Yeah.
Hmm. It's not just that like it makes it. They are faster to reach those conclusions. Mm-hmm. If you play a game and someone's on your team and they're not doing very well, not having the constant reminder on screen makes it more likely for you to just enjoy yourself more playing with that player who isn't as good.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not like the fact is hidden from you that they're not that good.
Yeah.
It's just that the game is not encouraging you to value that metric.
Yeah, the reason why we put those numbers in Fingence was not so that, I mean, I guess people can compete with it, but it wasn't the intention because, like you said, Mark, not every character is good at dealing damage and not every character can heal. But the numbers are really meant for you as the player to analyze your own abilities.
Yeah,
analyze your own stats.
And that's what's difficult about it is that those numbers do have real value in all sorts of games.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so hiding them from the player is taking something away from them.
Right.
Well, you can always hide them from other players and not your own, like not the individual.
For sure.
Yeah. And so I imagine like with curling, at the stones aren't measured. You said they weren't measured until the end of the end, right?
Right. You you take a peek and you make a guess. Like, because it happens quite often, actually, where the two stones are... They look almost identically apart from the button.
Yeah.
But you can't measure unless at the end of the end you're not sure.
Yeah.
And then any team can call for the measure. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, sometimes it'll be really close and like the viewer at home, if a camera right over the top, can't quite tell.
Uh-huh.
But both teams are pretty sure one was closer and nobody calls for a measure.
Hmm.
Like that's how good the sportsmanship is. If it's like a millimeter difference, if you can pretty much see that millimeter and the other team can pretty much see that millimeter, you don't have to confirm it. Mm. It is another weird thing about it.
Hmm.
But yeah, it is until the end. And so in curling, I wouldn't put much of the magic on the not withholding information, though, because the information is just very simple.
They're not withholding information. The information is there. It's just not measured precisely as it would be if you did the measure.
Right. That's true. I wouldn't say that's a huge reason of a contributor to curling's, the way it is.
Yeah.
I think that's just one way other games could probably do it.
Uh-huh.
You know,
I want to do a nice games jam where we take on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Take this challenge on.
It's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Should definitely.
Curling 2.0. Guys, you probably know this already, but Dale's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dale gave me some advice today.
Oh.
She told me how many cactuses or cacti was too many for me to have. I'm not there yet.
Okay, that's
She
good.
Also told me how much was too much to spend on a houseplant.
Oh.
Yep.
Okay.
She's a font of useful information.
That's
and
very true.
The cool thing is that like you can see some of her useful insights on Twitter.
Yes.
Ooh.
She shares stuff about game development and tweets some things about cats and Star Trek.
All accuracy.
Those are the three pillars of Nice Games Club Twitter.
Pretty much.
But it's not just that. Other stuff sneaks through as well.
Mm, tell me more, Mark.
Other stuff.
Sweet.
Sometimes we have recommendations of games that are made by our pals.
Yeah.
And those get retweeted, and so you can check those out as well at Nice Games Club on Twitter.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So that was, we kind of off-ramped onto off of curling.
So I'm really glad I wasn't the one to try to do this transition, because I was thinking about it also, and I'm like, I'm going to spin right off into just directly saying the thing, aren't I? And then Ellen took the bullet for me.
I was just going to say my topic is, but I mean, I'm glad you said
my things. Kill-death ratio for transitions is zero. 0-50 probably.
Yeah, that's nice. Yes. So gaming off-ramps. What is an off-ramp, you might be asking yourself, dear listener? I made it up. I don't know that I made it up. It actually probably is a term, but I don't know if it is. So somebody let me know. Listeners, let me know. Nicegames.club/feedback. But what I'm defining an off-ramp is the place where it makes most sense when you're in the middle of a gaming session to end your gameplay session.
Oh, a session.
Yeah.
Not a whole game.
Yes. Mm. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay. That's even interestinger than I thought.
Right. Okay. So so I was thinking, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. I was thinking about this with respect to, like, I guess, like, games that I will play
Stay
for hours
night.
On end. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Civilization.
Yeah.
Humankind. 4X games.
Yeah, we talked about this before. Like, one more turn is the gag with Civilization.
It's a whole thing. Yeah,
they put it in their advertising.
It's in their advertising.
And I always felt like that's advertising that you don't know how to design your experience.
Well, and I want to talk about that too, because, like, you might want to, I hope that listeners start considering where their off ramps are in their game.
Yeah.
I think I do think it's important for games to have off ramps, have places where it makes sense for, or the player can understand that this is a good place to stop.
Yeah.
But I think oftentimes in a game, an off ramp is like, you know, at the in between levels, or you just did like a major milestone in the game, like, I don't know, you beat a big boss or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. They're like bus stops.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're like bus stops. That's a better term for it.
I love that.
I'm going to retroactively rename it. yeah, so I was thinking about this with respect to, like, like Civilization and Humankind, in that, like, there are plenty of times when you've done something major, like you built a cultural wonder, or you ended a war, or you built a major city or something. I don't know. But, like, there's always other things that are holding your attention.
Yeah, you're always
constantly.
In the middle of something else. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll be like, well, I'll just wait until I finish the Taj Mahal, and then I'll end the game. And then, like, oh, no, the AI declared war on me. Well, shoot, now I got to deal with this. And then the Taj Mahal gets built, and you're, you know, handling this war. And you're like, well, I'll just finish this war with the AI. I almost got him now. And then you're really close to the science victory. So you're like, well, dang, I guess I got to start building the science, you know, building towards science victory now. And then you just, yeah. So it's difficult in those games. Well, I think those games are designed in such a way that it is difficult to end them due to the fact that there's just so much stuff that you can constantly be paying attention to.
Yeah.
It's like in
a queue too. It's like, it's always going. You have always, you're always cooking something up, and there's always something ready to be done, and you're always starting something new.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's core to the design, because otherwise you'd reach a breaking point and then you wouldn't have a lot of motivation to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can't change, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In those games. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you maybe could design it so that it worked differently, but then it'd be a different game.
Yeah. You'd be changing a lot more than you'd want to.
Yeah. So, like, I think in other games, like platformers or racing games or what have you, a lot of times your play session ends in between levels. So, like, for example, in Widget Satchel, I think when I've caught myself, like, I'll go through maybe the first, second level, and then I'll stop for a little while, mm-hmm. get something to drink, come back and do level 3. Because I think that, like, that just makes sense. As a player, you can kind of feel where it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is what I'm trying to bring a point across, is that, like, the player kind of knows where is a good place to stop.
Ooh,
where
you're talking about pacing.
Yeah, yeah, it's a pacing thing. It's a pacing thing. It's totally a pacing thing. And so, like, you as a developer need to recognize where the player is going to feel these things and make sure that they're put into the game in a place that makes sense.
Or if you're designing a 4X game, take them all out.
well, when you think about some games that I think having those overlapping experiences, it does give you the encouragement to come back to it.
Yes.
It also helps when you start a new play session to wind into
things.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think the most successful games that do this, like Metroidvanias or platformers, have the main thing you're doing have these really defined bus stops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then other things are always happening in the background, but they're not so important to keep you playing when you've decided it, when you get to the ending point of this, the main trunk of the experience.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of those games, too, have, like, safety areas or save points.
Yeah.
Where,
yeah.
like, you know, this is a good place for you to rest up, and this is where you'd, like, pause the game or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even, like, in a game like Dark Souls where you can't technically pause the game, you know, you go to somewhere where it's safe, like a vendor or whatever, where you won't get attacked by enemies, and you can do that and then end the game there. So, yeah, I think those are good points.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious as to how, I guess I want to figure out good places or how to design games around this idea, this concept. I mean, it's effectively a pacing concept.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious as to y'all's thoughts on how to think about that when you're designing a game.
One of the things that bubbled up for me as you were talking about the different types of games and the different experiences is like intensity of focus.
Mm-hmm.
So like the fun thing about 4X, at least for me, and I have not played nearly as much 4X stuff as you have, Steven. but the thing that did feel satisfying is like that kind of like constant hum of activity.
Yeah.
You know, like it's kind of just, you're like chugging along and there's stuff to do and you've got some momentum and you get it to like a nice pace when things are like popping up and there's always like progress. You're always making this progress.
Well, part
right?
of the fun of those games is making things as efficient as possible, yeah. right? So that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. Well, compare that to like to a Metroidvania, for example.
Yeah.
You might have, I'm thinking specifically of some of the little robots in Metroid Dread. You might be smashing your head against the wall.
Yes.
For many, many minutes, and it's taking all of your focus and it's taking all of your skill, and you can't even think about stopping until either you get it done or you get so frustrated that you need to take a break.
Right.
But both of those forks, right? You did the thing, or you got so frustrated and you needed to take a break, are preceded directly by intense focus and like intense concentration.
Yeah.
And that kind of intensity just is like isn't in a 4X game, I don't think. At least it hasn't been in my experience.
I mean, I guess the closest you get to is like a war, a particular important battle in a war.
Yeah, it's hard to be single-minded in those experiences.
Yeah, because even when you're doing a war, like you still got other cities and they still got other things they got.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. That is an interesting point though that you bring up, Ellen, because like each time a player takes an off ramp, they won't get back on the highway. I'm sorry. Basically, each time a player, you know, stops playing your game, there's a chance that they won't come back to it.
Hmm.
And I think, like, I suppose, as game developers, ideally you just buy the game and you give us the money, but we would like you to play through the game too, because, you know, we spend a lot of time on it. So each time that you give players opportunities like that to stop, you know, to stop playing their game or your game, you know, there's a potential opportunity for them to forget about the game or realize that, oh, wait, I actually wasn't having that much fun with the game or whatever, and just not come back to it. You know, there's a bunch of things like that to keep in mind, which is kind of weird. But like, I guess ultimately, I don't know that you can like design a game around you can design a game to keep people playing
it. Yeah, like you're asking, you know, like what gets, if you're just, you know, okay, just to keep with the, it's like kind of late now, so my brain's getting tired, which means I'm going to say some goofy metaphors. But to continue with the road idea.
Yes.
Like, how do you make sure that they're just getting on the off ramp to go like fill up with gas and then they're just going to get back on the highway or whatever versus they're getting off the off ramp and they think they're going to go get gas, but instead they get distracted and they drive to the world's biggest yard, like ball twine, you know, like,
yeah.
how do you get them back on the road? And one of the ways you do it is you make the road interesting, right? Yes. So coming back to the Metroid example, I just love how Metroid becomes such a great like way to talk about game design, because I love that franchise so much.
Yeah.
So anyway, so like you beat the boss and you go to the save zone after that you unlocked because you beat the boss.
Right.
So glad that there was one right there. So nice that they put it there, right? So then you save and you're going to go get your soda. But the thing is like that boss was on your way to a goal you had regarding the map.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So like now that you've beaten the boss, that's an obstacle that's cleared. It wasn't just that you beat a challenge. It's that it was – that challenge was actually an obstacle in the way of your goal.
Yeah.
And you have a goal in the – you have a long-term goal of beating the game, right? And, you know, getting off the whatever godforsaken planet you're on this time. But you also have a near-term goal, which is getting your – you know, you're going after this one part of the map because you think that there's a big upgrade there. Or, you know, you need to figure out how the – you know, just where the elevator is or something like that. You know, you have this near-term goal that's relating to where you are in the map.
Right.
And the boss that you beat, that high-intensity moment – that was an obstacle in the way of your goal. So that goal is still there in front of your mind now that the obstacle is clear to just draw you back onto the freeway.
Yeah. It's having those, having a reason to come back, but not, but letting the player be satisfied to take the break. Right.
Yeah.
Which is that clearing that obstacle.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Because I think a lot about games where you have to keep so much in your head as you're going towards the goal. That if you leave now, after getting through an obstacle on the way there, then it's going to take you longer to get back and going.
Yeah.
And so I like a lot. The example I was thinking of from Metroid is when you do reach a new area, that's a good time to stop.
Yeah.
You get a cutscene, you get teased, and then you're like, all right, it's time for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then that tease will help you come back.
Right.
But that's different. That's setting up a new goal. Right,
but it's still a tantalizing reason to come back to the game.
Right, but Ellen kind of like made it broadened the definition of kind of what I was thinking.
Okay.
Like as long as you have that goal in your mind still, whether it was just presented to you or whether you just got a significant percentage through, and had that moment of that where the pacing is now slowed down.
Yeah,
as long as that short term goal or a short term goal is available to you or handed to you. Then you do have a reason to come back.
Yeah.
Because there are games that either I have to keep going or else it's going to take me forever to get started again.
Yeah.
Or games where when I do leave them for the day, I think I'm like, I'm never going to come back to this, am I?
Right. Yeah. I'm reminded of Cuphead in this respect because I think that I think the off ramps were like in between bosses, right? But like I would keep bashing my head against one of the bosses I was having a particularly hard time with because I felt like if I don't beat it, like I felt like the off ramp was coming and that was and I wanted to get to that off the one that's coming up instead of the one that I had previously.
Right. And you don't want to retrain your reflexes.
Yes.
So you got to get through that.
Right. Yeah.
But then I'll quit. Then I'll quit.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that like it can also become more apparent to players when they want to stop, you know, as they're playing different parts of your game too. And it'll make, you know, it'll become more clear to players when they want to stop. I think that this analysis that players are doing while they're playing a game when they want to end it, is more difficult when you're playing a multiplayer game because there's like some more social aspects of it.
Yeah.
Because like just because you want to stop doesn't mean other people want to stop. And sometimes it can be difficult for you to end and other people to continue to play. So like there's like a social pressure to continue to play the game even when you're like done with it. Mm-hmm. And that makes it kind of difficult. Especially if your game has relatively short play like games. Like a fighting game, for instance, fighting games, you know, are relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just keep going over and over and over again. And it's pretty soon, you know, you've been sparring for 2 hours. That can be an aspect of it. But like I guess that's difficult to test for.
That's a game genre that essentially is not interested in the question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
The game gives you plenty of opportunities to stop. You literally, after every match, you can just stop.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't create enough problems for itself that it needs to solve with that.
Yes,
probably.
How does this idea of off ramps relate to something like idle games?
Oh,
so
yeah,
like the one that I've been kind of poking around is called Summoner's Greed, and it doesn't, I mean, it's a good, it's like a idle game slash summoning game slash tower defense kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's cute, but it's got all, you know, it's got a lot of the mechanics that and dynamics that you kind of see in this genre. Like there's like 18 types of currency and you need all of them to be really good. And yeah, of course you can pay for them and there's a deal or something. So I'm kind of at the point where it's like, all right, in order to really enjoy the game in a time scale that like is human, as opposed to like cosmic, I've got to start spending some money, and I'll throw them a few dollars because I, you know, I'll send them some money because I've been playing it, but like I'm not going to spend $79 to get 300 purple gems and 200 red gems and whatever.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because like you play what you've got until the point where the game beats you, and then it's like the off ramp is, okay, now I'm going to wait until my free coins recharge. And then I'm going to come back to it. So it's like, it's weird because like the off ramp seems related to the idea that you should be paying for the next attempt.
What it is, it's forced on you and you don't want it.
Yeah.
And because a natural off ramp is a threat to the business model of a game
right,
like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so they don't want you to ever think about that. And you'll eventually get exhausted and have to stop for a while. Mm. And they do also want to make it easy to get back onto it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But that you never feel satisfied and ready to walk away. It's part of the design.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, those games like give you reminders and stuff constantly to let you know, oh, we're here for you. You know, please join, come back again.
When your free coins are ready.
Yeah, exactly. So those games are built to keep people playing them.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that too, because I think that it's kind of, that's unhealthy to design games around that kind of thing where you're constantly supposed to be engaging with the game. Mm-hmm. I think that MMOs have that kind of have that design around them too. And part of it is also community based because like, you know, your community around you is not actively like pressuring you to spend money and spend time playing the game, but like it's a social aspect of it too. Right.
Yeah.
So, like, in order for you to spend time with your friends, you need to spend time with your friends in this game. And so that is incentive to continue to play the game. And then also, you know, the game gives you plenty of different, like, daily missions and whatnot to keep you coming back to it and keep you playing it over and over again. And for longer, because that is ultimately more content for the MMO, which, you know, makes it more enticing for other people to play the game. Mm. So it kind of, like, feeds into itself. So I want to talk about that specifically because like I think that even Civ and Humankind, like, you know, I like those games a lot, but I don't think that it's healthy that those games encourage you to continue to play. I kind of wish that those games did something that like Wii Sports and stuff do, where like the more physical games where after like an hour of play, the game will remind you, oh, you've been playing this for an hour. Maybe it's time to take a break. Mm-hmm. I get annoyed when it brings that up because I'm like, I'm not done playing game. Shut up. But but understandably, especially in a physical game, like you can hurt yourself if you, you know, play it for too long.
Right. And that basically, they don't solve the problem mechanically.
Yeah.
They just literally just solve the problem any way they can.
Yeah.
And I guess what you're saying is that's if that's all you can manage to do, fine, go ahead and do it.
I mean, at least do that.
Yeah. But it's valuable enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I wish that Civ told me I've been playing it for 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, actually, there's another 4X game that I had played a while back called Anno 1800. Mm-hmm. And that game would actually, I think the narrator would be like, oh, it looks like you've been playing this game for 3 hours. Maybe it's time to take a break. and the way that he'd say it is basically exactly how I'd say it. So it just didn't make you feel like you'd want to take a break.
Yeah.
Felt like the guy was being patronizing. Yeah. But
listeners, feel free to clip that out and put it in your own game.
Yeah, please do. Let me know if you do. But like at the very least, they did put in that reminder. Yeah. So I think that like it, yeah. If
I wonder if it like that game just has a really bad memory leak and just wants to make sure you shut it down before.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I mean, you don't have to listen to the voice.
Yeah, that's true. I think ultimately you want to design ways for players to feel like they can end the game, especially since there's a lot of reasons why people want to stop playing games, and it's not necessarily because they want to stop playing the game, but maybe something is taking their attention. For instance, there are parents who play games, and sometimes their kid needs them at this specific moment, and they you can't just like, you know, wait until you get to a save point.
Yeah, a lot of those survival horror games or yeah. FromSoft games that you can't truly pause.
Right.
I always hear new parents complain about that.
Right.
Like, do they not understand that humans have lives?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Nope. Yeah.
Right. So, like, having some method to actively, you know, pause, even if it's just a pause, like a regular pause instead of like an off-ramp sort of thing, mm-hmm. I think is important. But I think, yeah, having dedicated places for players to feel comfortable ending the game is good.
Yeah, because, I think so too.
Yeah, I think it's also an aspect of trust between, you know, developer yeah. game and player.
Yeah, I mean, it's really if you're designing in off ramps, I mean, there's so much you just said I think is worth double clicking on. Yeah. So like if you're designing off ramps, it does mean that you are not designing into those kind of like black hat dynamics that mm-hmm. I was describing with the, you know, the idle game that
yeah.
makes you play like pay to continue.
Right.
But also, so like there is that aspect of trust. Like if you have off ramps and it's like, yes, we were okay with you stepping away from our game because mm-hmm. we know it's so good that you'll come back.
Yeah.
But also like the idea that the off ramp is for like letting people take a break, like a breath and taking a break from the game mm-hmm. and then coming back into it. And then the pause menu is for like interruptions.
Yes.
I think that's a good way of thinking about it. It definitely jives with my own experience because mm-hmm. I have both. Like sometimes I just want to go and get a bubbly drink and have like a bubbly drink.
Yep.
And other times my dog is eating something she mm-hmm. shouldn't and I need to pause the game and fix that.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's two ways to go about designing for this.
Yeah.
One is make the game you're going to make mm. and see how you can like, oh, this is how long a play session should be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or I think both of these are valid, but I think it might be more successful if your aim is to have useful, like, you know, off ramps in your game.
Yeah.
Is to think about your play session, what a play session is going to do for a player.
Yes.
Really, really early.
Okay.
Because then you can start putting up your design and your mechanics against that, like yeah. it's a design pillar.
Yeah.
Like, I want these sessions to be no more than 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then everything you do feeds into servicing that goal. And I mean, it's an arbitrary goal, but if you've got it, then you can design for it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, yeah, you may not feel comfortable deciding that right away. Mm. You may feel more comfortable deciding other things early. Your first couple of choices are always going to be informed by nothing. So yes. It's, you know, just depends on what your first couple of choices are. But if that's one of them, if you want to do that, I think you can be very successful designing for that. Otherwise, you do have to just keep in mind like and design once the game presents itself with a natural ending point, or perhaps you realize that this is now that you've got the game on its feet, oh man, a play session is going to take longer than I would be comfortable with this design that I've made.
Right.
And then you got to start untangling things a little bit
and
tweaking it into it. So you can have it naturally find its own place, or you can, you know, make a judgment call later on, or you could start from the top.
Yeah.
But either way, and if you are trying to design in a sieve-like way where one more turn, mm-hmm. Or if you're doing black hat mobile games, this game design, you need to know about this too.
Right.
So you can design for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a 4X game. I can't remember the name of it that like is supposed to last an hour at most.
They all say that.
Well, I don't know that they do.
Tom, this sounds like a 4X game that I might play.
I have to look into it. But yeah, it was designed to be played within a lunch break time.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's a fascinating thing. It's interesting, too, because like the decisions that they made in terms of like the decisions you have to make in the game must not be so complicated that you can spend a good 5-10 minutes thinking them through.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I would love a good 20-turn world domination 4X game.
Yeah.
Mm. Where because like things would just happen so quickly.
Yeah.
But it also gives you the opportunity to design for lots of different outcomes.
Yeah,
it's true. That people could try really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like small planet mode. It's only an hour long because everything is tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fun.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, oh, good stuff, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and the difference between GitHub and Git. We like hearing from you, so tweet back or email us to contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, stop by at nicegames.club/discord and say what's up. Next week, we'll be looking at level design with High Moon Studios' Nina Murata. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Did I say the number of cactuses?
You didn't.
I like that you didn't say that.
Because it could be some extreme.
I'm just
going to
let people guess.
Still under it.
I'm just going to let people guess. It's going to drive Lane crazy. Okay.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.